Ladies and gentlemen, good day and welcome to the conference call on new law on data privacy proposed. India takes a leaf from the GDPR book. As a reminder, all participant lines will be in the listen-only mode, and there will be an opportunity for you to ask questions after the presentation concludes. Should you need assistance during the conference call, please signal an operator by pressing star then zero on your touchtone phone. Please note that this conference is being recorded. I now hand the conference over to Ms. Gauri Gokhale. Thank you, and over to you, ma'am.
Thank you. Good afternoon, good morning, and good evening to our participants here who have joined from different jurisdictions. Thanks for being with us here today. We will be discussing, as all of us are aware, the new data protection law. Though it is in the bill form and further deliberations are likely, as I will briefly discuss hereafter, it is a good time to at least start getting familiarized with the law so that we are aware as to what are the further steps to be taken by the industry. Where should we sort of try to provide further inputs to the government and the committee? Which are the areas where we should start, re-looking at our processes? And therefore, we thought it may be a good idea to discuss this right away. Now, before I begin asking questions as a moderator to my fellow panelists, I thought it may be a good idea to just understand where we are in terms of overall technology space and the digital space in the Indian context. So as we are aware, last couple of years have been really busy for those who are in the TMT space overall, which is technology, media and telecom, because government is revisiting the entire scheme of laws, regulations, policy that affects this industry. And of course, the allied industries such as fintech, etc., which we will discuss. So one of the key areas has been the data protection. As we know, it has been discussed in various contexts. Whichever issue that we look at, whichever discussion paper that has come out from various regulators in last few years always touched upon this issue to the extent that even the net neutrality paper discussed this aspect a couple of years back. So obviously, in each regulator's mind, data protection has been the key area. Though we did have a data protection law in a very, a preliminary form under the 2011 rules that were framed under the data, under the Information Technology Act of India, those rules were limited to sensitive personal data and information, and the compliances were also pretty limited. Last year, when we had the Supreme Court judgment of in the case of privacy, the 9-judge bench basically declared that right to privacy is a fundamental right of the citizens of India. And such right, of course, other than enforcement vis-a-vis the state, they also recommended that the informational privacy should be protected vis-a-vis the state as well as the private bodies, and recommended a comprehensive law in that respect. Before the judgment came out, the METI, which is our Ministry of Information and Technology, had already set up a committee, which committee has basically, recommended this law. So this committee was already set up. And therefore, the Supreme Court said that they will not, deliberate further on that because the committee was already looking at it. So the new law that has been now proposed was after a consultation of about more than a year. Our team was involved in the industry consultation for various industry organizations. So in fact, we are quite aware of the pain points of the industry in terms of, various items that we will discuss today. And unfortunately, the first fears of the industry, in fact, have come true. For example, data localization issues, etc. So having said that, there are certain positive aspects as well, which we will discuss. But it appears that this entire legislation is a reaction to, three, four situations. One is, of course, the privacy judgment. Second one probably is, you know, the fear of unknown, you know, which almost all the regulators are going through today is, you know, not knowing how the data is being handled in the digital world, and therefore, you know, having more of a, you know, protective, reaction to the entire scheme of data. The third issue, of course, is the development, as we know, under, in the European context, it is GDPR. And therefore, there was certain benchmarking available with the Indian, you know, committee that some things have already been implemented in the European jurisdiction, then why not in India? So that was also playing on their mind. The fourth issue is, of course, the security concerns, because as we know, there have been data leaks, there have been, fears of data being taken, you know, away through, say, phones or otherwise outside the country, and therefore security concerns. Arising out of that. And secondly, this is something, again, going back to the fear of unknown. So because of all these, you will see a somewhat protectionist law. But at the same time, as I said, there are certain, things that which are, for example, breach notification, etc., which are slightly better, or the right of erasure, which are better than the GDPR. So, let me now request my colleague Karthik to basically start about, you know, by explaining to what exact sets of data the law applies, what is the territorial jurisdiction, and in terms of the overall scheme of the act, how does he look at on the applicability. Karthik, over to you.
Thanks, Gauri. So before I do a deep dive into, you know, the applicability, I thought it makes sense for us to just touch upon a key, a few key definitions and few key terms which we're going to be referring to as part of this discussion. So I think the first one would be the concept of a data controller. In the context of the proposed law, the data controller, the nomenclature has been changed to a data fiduciary. The intent behind changing this nomenclature appears to be to, you know, establish a higher threshold or relationship of trust on the data controller. In terms of who would qualify to be a data fiduciary, it would be anyone who determines the purpose or means of processing. So I think this continues as is. A data processor is anyone who's essentially processing on behalf of the data fiduciary, where the data fiduciary retains the primary obligation and the data processor is processing on behalf of the fiduciary. The third and the most important concept, and you know, the person, the part where the data use subject has been tried to be made central, or the center of this entire law, has been referred to as the data principle. A data principle is any natural person to whom personal data is referred to. So essentially, by a natural person, you're excluding corporations or companies or non-natural persons from the ambit of this act. And I think that gives us a segue to talk about, you know, what is completely excluded from the ambit of this act, which is anonymized data and non-personal data has been completely excluded, which is pretty encouraging in that sense. Now, jumping into what this law particularly applies to, the first concept that it applies to is any kind of personal information or personal data. Personal data is any information which is capable of identifying a natural person. So this can include characteristics, traits, attributes, and whether or not this does it directly or indirectly does not matter for the purposes of this for this proposed law. Another sect of information which continues from the old 2011 law is the sensitive personal data. This is essentially, you know, information which is in place on a higher threshold in terms of sensitivity, and therefore, you know, there are higher obligations placed in relation to processors who process or controllers who have such access to such information. So this includes, you know, what you would generally expect, which would be health information, biometric information, genetic data, you know, sexual orientation, etc. A few important or peculiar things which the Indian law proposes to include is, you know, caste or tribe, as well as religious and political affiliations have also been included. You know, the its applicability in the Indian context would have to be looked at in terms of, you know, practical applicability, just given how, openly people discuss their religious and political affiliations, as well as the fact that, you know, it's very easy to identify people on the basis of their last names, and therefore the inclusion of caste or tribe you know, practically how it plays out would have to be seen. Two additional things which would be pretty important here to highlight would be the inclusion of the terms password and financial information within the ambit of sensitive personal data. Now, given the inclusion of these two particular items, there wasn't consensus at the level of the committee itself. Some committee members, you know, had a differing view, saying that passwords are too generic to be included, whether it's financial information is too wide. And, you know, there are they quoted the fact that there are several jurisdictions across the world which do not recognize financial information. So I think this is just in terms of, you know, what is the kind of information which is sought to be protected. Now, in terms of who does this law apply to, this law is intended to be made applicable to anyone who does automated data processing. So the sequitur to this would be the fact that non-automated data processing, which would be manual data processing, has been excluded. However, it's been excluded only in terms of some obligations. It's not been completely carved out. And even to be excluded, there are certain thresholds which are required to be met, which include, you know, a turnover test, as well as the fact that, you know, the entity doing manual processing has not processed more than 100 data sets in per day in the past 12 months. Now jumping back into who this would therefore apply to, it would apply to governmental entities as well as private players. And therefore, anyone who processes data within India would be covered by this proposed law, regardless of who this data particularly applies to. That being said, the committee appears to have been mindful of India's BPO industry and has provided that, you know, they may notify certain data sets of non-Indians which may be exempt from certain obligations, and therefore, you know, giving leeway to the outsourcing and BPO industry. I think one important thing which would be very, of much interest to our offshore friends would be the fact that this law proposes an extraterritorial application. And therefore, it applies to any processors or data fiduciaries who process data of Indians, but they've tried to limit it. And going by the Australian test, they've limited to anyone who carries on business in India or has a systemic activity of processing data of India or does profiling of data principles in India. So I think, you know, there isn't much clarity at this stage on what carry-on business would mean, and therefore we may have to look at international examples which have said the fact that, you know, regularly, or consistently does processes information for the purposes of profit-making. This could be one of those definitions, but I think, you know, in summary, this is essentially the applicability of the law as it's proposed.
Thanks, Karthik. So the kind of law that we are looking at is a horizontal law, as we mentioned earlier. It doesn't specifically identify a particular industry to which it will apply in a particular way. So it is applying to all the industries in a sort of consistent manner. Interestingly, the TRAI, which is our telecom regulator, had come out with a separate report on protection of data of the telecom users and had made certain recommendations, which the committee, of course, has also taken into account. But we do have localization requirement for the telecom data. Separately, the healthcare regulator came out with a proposed law called Disha, where they were talking about healthcare data protection separately. Then you have the Reserve Bank of India, which came out with its certain rules with respect to localization of the financial data by the, you know, payment system operators. So as you can see, each separate regulator is also some way or the other trying to deal with the data within their jurisdiction. The committee report, which is, you know, about more than 200 pages, in fact identifies other than three named laws, which is the Right to Information Act, the Information Technology Act, and the I think these are the two acts they have actually recognized. So other than, you know, they have said that there are about 50 other laws which could probably have to be amended. And interestingly, they say that each regulator will have to, in consultation, revisit their own regulations and amend their laws to bring it in line with this particular law. So you may have a flurry of amendments coming out once this law is notified in the final form. Now let us quickly deal with the data fiduciary, as Karthik explained, and the data processor. So data fiduciary and data processor have their responsibilities have been specifically separated out. Data processor is an individual, as Karthik mentioned, is simply a entity that processes the data, while data fiduciary determines the purpose of processing. And therefore, insofar as data processor is concerned, their obligation is limited to accountability, transparency, and security. And the majority of the obligations are of the data fiduciary, even in terms of liabilities. So, Zefa, why don't you explain, what are the key obligations of the data fiduciary, and especially in the context of consent notice and purpose?
No, absolutely. Just taking leap from what my colleague Gauri said. So, data fiduciary, as per the Act, is someone who is given paramount importance, obligations, as well as in terms of liabilities too. It flows onto them. So, in terms of any sort of breaches, in sort of any sort of compliances, largely it is the data fiduciary who is going to be responsible. There could be common situations where the data principal shares the data with the data fiduciary processes itself, or actually further transfers it to third parties. But if there's any third party breaches, vis-a-vis the data principal and the third party, there is definitely no contract. So in those cases also, it is the obligation of the data fiduciary to ensure that the data is, overall protected and it's given its necessary due. And of course, my colleagues will talk about further processing of data. Now, since we've understood from an overall perspective, what is the applicability of this new bill, to whom does it apply from, in terms of national persons, what are the categorizations of data, it is important to understand that how will it practically roll out, in the sense that when a data fiduciary wants to collect data or a data principal wants to share its data, what are the two key important parameters which need to be kept in mind. So I'll split it into two. One is the notice part, and the second is the consent part. So at all times when a data fiduciary is actually collecting data from a data principal, he needs to give a notice to the data principal. The data fiduciary needs to give a notice at the time of collection, or if it's not collected directly from the data principal, in a time which is reasonable and soon. Now there are 7-8 important criteria which need to be fulfilled in the notice. The draft bill has not introduced any particular form in relation to the notice, but they have given broad contours. So I'll quickly touch upon certain key points vis-a-vis the notice. First and foremost, the notice needs to be clear, and it needs to be in a concise and an easily comprehensible manner. Now this is very progressive drafting, whereby they are saying that the data principal needs to be aware of what is being collected, what is happening, and it also gives provisions that it needs to be in multiple languages, which essentially means that if a data principal is belonging of a certain region, and it's assumed that there is a particular vernacular language or any other language needs to be followed which he can understand, probably the notice needs to be in that language as well. So broadly, it needs to be clear and concise. Of course, after that is achieved, one of the most important thing is, for what are you collecting the data? So the purpose needs to be spelled out clearly. Then of course, what is the nature of data? Who's going to collect it? Details of their data fiduciary, in terms of if there are third party transfers, you need to mention who the third party transferees are. If there's any cross-border transfer, you need to also provide for that. And more importantly, you also need to essay out withdrawal rights. So these are the broad premises. There are a couple of others too, but this is largely what the notice should, the broad contours of the notice need to spell out. The DPA, the authority, is soon going to roll out a code of practice which would actually give further guidance on the notice. Currently, there's no draft form or, template which can be used for a notice. Just one key point before I move on to consent when it comes to notice, that the data fiduciary needs to identify the third parties to whom the data is going to be transferred. It needs to be spelled upfront. In such situations, you actually need to spell out the names of the entities or the individuals who are going to be third-party recipients. Now, that can actually get pretty interesting in this, you know, 21st century, whereby service providers are changing constantly. And if some third-party service provider changes, do you need to go back to the data principal, take its consent, or do you, you know, need to send updated notices? That's slightly unclear, but I'm sure with the passage of time, there will be more clarity. So once we've achieved the notice part, now comes the second part, which is, of course, the second key touchstone, which is consent. And the law actually spells out, you know, what should be akin to consent. As our colleagues pointed out, we have personal data and we have sensitive personal data. So the law looks at it in two different ways. I'll quickly touch upon what are the requirements of consent when it comes to personal data. There are essentially four criteria which need to be fulfilled. One, the consent needs to be free, which means there has to be no coercion. Second, it has to be informed. In other words, it means that when you're giving your notice, you need to basically, you know, chart out the entire landscape for what, why, and how. Third, it needs to be specific, which is again a very important point, that it needs to have linkage with the purpose and its collection. And four, it needs to be clear. Now, friends, this is again, you know, very progressive drafting where it says that what do you mean by clear? It is something which is consent is indicated through an affirmative action in a meaningful context. So it can't be random automated consents which are taken which are not meaningful. So there has to be a positive act on or on behalf of by the data principal where he actually or she is consenting and making a clear affirmative action for consent. So this is broadly in relation to consent for personal data. There are few other criteria when it comes to sensitive personal data in which the consent needs to be explicit, and in addition, you also need to mention the consequences of data processing, and more importantly, when it comes to sensitive personal data, when consent is taken, and if there are varied purposes for which varied data could be collected, you know, you only need to take data relevant to the purposes for which it's been collected. So you can actually, you know, you need to segregate it. Not, it's not like a bucket full which you can collect for a limited purpose. And last but not the least, and I will conclude on this, one interesting aspect about the law when it comes to consent, the authorities have clearly laid that it has, you know, they have provided that the consent cannot be subjective vis-a-vis providing any goods or services. So in other words, it means that if consent has been taken and certain data has been shared in relation to a particular purpose, and tomorrow if the data fiduciary wants to collect ancillary data which is not in relation to the purpose, and if that ancillary data is not provided, the data fiduciary cannot deny, you know, the relevant goods or services for which the data is collected. So in short, the purpose and the collection of data go hand in hand. So that's friends, just to conclude quickly on, you know, consents and notices. Over to you, Gauri.
Thanks, Huzaifa. So if we can look at, you know, in the Indian context, as we know, you know, it's not that all the companies may have a digital relationship with their data subjects, right? So for example, if there is a particular hospital, say in a, you know, smaller town, they may be definitely collecting the sensitive data, and at the time of collection of that data, you know, may have, you know, taken certain whatever consents that are required as per the healthcare law. However, they may not necessarily take the consent as per this law. Suppose they have not taken those consents. That means if they have to use that data in the future for, you know, any follow-up action, etc., the question that will arise that whether, you know, all these consents will have to be put in place. I know I'm slightly exaggerating here, but the question that I'm raising is whether a digital relationship now is going to be very essential to implement all these notices and consent. Because otherwise, in a real world, it's going to be very difficult to, you know, sort of follow up with all your data subjects to get such consent. And the exceptions that Karthik mentioned when he spoke earlier, in my view, should be definitely expanded to much wider, you know, sort of entities which are collecting data. Otherwise, at least, you know, in a phase-wise manner, the implementation could be implemented, because otherwise, it's going to be very difficult for those smaller companies to go and, you know, do all these aspects that Huzaifa mentioned. The second thing I would want to comment upon is as between the fiduciary and the controller, we will see how the interset clauses sort of develop, because the main obligation has been put on the fiduciary, and therefore of all these compliances, and if there is a breach, say from a processor side, for example, if the consent, the requirement of obtaining consent, that has been, that process has been delegated to the processor, and they do not comply with certain aspects, and the fiduciary is held liable, then how would the indemnities work? So that is the other piece, the contractual clauses will develop around that. The third comment I would want to make in the context of consent, all the explanation that Josefa provided about pre-consent and specific and all of that, interestingly, this law itself says that it is the data fiduciary's obligation to prove that the consent has been taken in this particular manner. Now, when you see pre-consent from a legal context, and they have actually referred to the Contract Act, the Contract Act says that the consent is free when it is devoid of coercion, etc., among other things. So how does one prove a negative becomes a question mark technically, and it goes against your established principles providing evidence under the Evidence Act. So it's slightly tricky. I believe, I at least hope that this onerous provision of providing putting the burden of proof of proving the free consent is removed from the proposed law. Otherwise, it's going to be very tricky in the legal proceedings, and this particular provision, it's just one sentence sneaked in, but the implications could be much wider. Now, Adin, I come to you for us to understand from you. The consent aspect that Josefa mentioned becomes just one of the grounds of processing under this law. So why don't you explain briefly on what are the other grounds of processing? That means even without consent, one can still process the data, and in which are those situations? And very briefly, linking it to purpose as well.
Sure, Gauri, thank you. So, as my colleagues already mentioned, the draft bill is primarily consent-based, which is a win situation for individuals in India. Unlike the existing law, for processing of personal data, consent is required as well, whereas earlier only for sensitive personal data, consent was required. The draft bill provides that consent is required for both processing of personal data as well as sensitive personal data. Except in the case of sensitive personal data, the consent should be explicit consent. Now, just going to the grounds for processing of data, of course, one is where clear consent is provided, but there are certain exceptions where consent need not be provided, right? Now, these could include where functions of the state need to be exercised, such as functions of the parliament or the legislature, where the government is required to provide services or benefits to the data subject, where the government is to provide any certificates or licenses or permits to an individual. Consent may also not be required in cases where data is required to be processed in order to comply with law or in order to comply with a court order. Also, interestingly enough, two new concepts have also been introduced in the draft bill for personal data. One is where data is required to be processed for something called prompt action, which is clarified to be where emergency services are required for the data subject, where in cases of medical emergency, where certain safety and assistance services are to be provided in the case of a disaster or in the case of a public disorder. Now, so this is an extra added on ground for processing. Another one, importantly, is in the employment relationship. Now, this was something which was not addressed or clarified in the existing legal regime. The draft bill provides that in an employment relationship where data is required to be processed by the employer with respect to the employee, such as for recruitment or termination of the employee relationship, or where a certain service or a benefit is to be provided to the employee, or even in the case of verifying the attendance of the employee or the assessment of performance of the employee, in these scenarios, a specific consent may not be required. And the draft bill also clarifies that, in these kind of situations, it may require a disproportionate effort required
on the behalf of the employer entity. So hence, where there is an employer-employee relationship that is created, for these kind of scenarios, specific consent need not be required for processing of personal data of the employee. Now, moving on, there are certain additional reasonable purposes which have been prescribed by the government, such as where processing is required in overall public interest, where it's required to be processed in the interest of data of the data subject himself or herself. Also, the government from time to time can include more purposes within the reasonable grounds for processing ambit, such as whistleblowing, credit scoring, debt recovery, in the event of information security, and like. Now, moving on to sensitive personal data. Now, as I said, the key difference here is that explicit consent is required for processing as opposed to consent for personal data. Now, the carve-outs are more or less the same as what I mentioned, which includes the functions of the state to comply with law or the court order, and where prompt action is necessary, such as in the case of medical emergencies. One exclusion is that of the employer-employee relationship, which I had earlier mentioned. This is not there for sensitive personal data. It is only there for personal data. So hence, since this has not been clarified, one would presume that necessary consents would be required where sensitive personal data is to be processed. That's it, Gauri, on the grounds for processing of both personal and sensitive personal data. Over back to you.
Sure. So thanks, Aaron. So I would want to comment on a couple of items here. One, of course, I omitted mentioning this before, but the Aadhaar Act also, of course, will need to get amended. And the point here is that if you see all the exclusions that have been provided, as Aaron mentioned, those exclusions will, of course, apply in relation to, the processing of data for the purpose under the Act. So therefore, the Aadhaar Act also would get, included in terms of the exceptions. So again, we'll need to see the interplay because of the litigation, the objections that are being raised against use of Aadhaar, collection of information. So we need to see how it ultimately develops because for the digital economy, the government is, wanting to use Aadhaar extensively for authentication, etc. The second, item in relation to the employee data, under the earlier law, as Aaron mentioned, there was no exclusion. And interestingly, it so many times, we used to get these questions that the only information that we may be collecting is, say, a password. Now, as Karthik had mentioned, there was a debate about use of passwords, and there is no definition provided under the Act insofar as the password is concerned. Under the old law, the password was very, very widely defined. And then under the current law, there is complete absence of the definition. So if at all in the final law, if the password is defined to mean that any authentication, word for the purpose of accessing other sensitive information, then to that extent, it could be acceptable. Otherwise, for example, if an employee login, if that is viewed as a password, then and the sensitive, data provisions apply, then again, it becomes cumbersome and goes back, to the issues that Aaron mentioned. So this is going to be a little tricky unless the password is explained. Then of course in the employee context, under the old law also we used to get several questions about how can we keep track about the employee emails for the purpose of checking if there is any fraud being committed. Can we do the other operations such as analytics of the emails? So several of these questions that we used to receive. So I believe at least in the context, assuming none of the sensitive data is sort of part of this processing, many of these things may get simplified without notice, etc., or rather without consent, etc., in the employee context. Now let us deal with a significant data fiduciary. That's a new concept that has been introduced, and certain onerous obligations have been sort of imposed upon such data fiduciaries, which are over and above the obligations that we discussed thus far. So Karthik, why don't you explain the concept and what are the onerous obligations that will be imposed on such fiduciaries?
Sure, thanks, Gauri. So I think a significant data fiduciary is someone, you know, it's a specific class of data fiduciaries which have been, you know, which have been delineated under this law, proposed law. These is any data fiduciary capable of causing significantly greater harm as a consequence of data processing is supposed to be a significant data fiduciary. As per the current construct of the law, such an entity would need to register with the authority, and I think this has been done with the intention that the authority needn't constantly track who's doing, you know, processing which may be capable of causing harm. Instead, the authority itself will either specify a data fiduciary or a class of data fiduciaries who will be classified as a significant data fiduciary and therefore required to register with it. While arriving at a decision as to whether or not someone should be classified, you know, as such, the authority is likely to consider the volume of data being processed, the sensitivity of data, the possibility of harm, and including whether or not new technology is being used. Jumping straight to, you know, if one is classified as a significant data fiduciary, what are the obligations that get imposed? So I think the first obligation is the mandatory appointment of a data protection officer. So I think this obligation would apply once you're a significant data fiduciary. You'd have an officer who would be the nodal person responsible for interacting with the authority as well as managing compliances internally. In addition, there's this concept of a mandatory data audit, which would be done by an empaneled auditor, independent auditor, but empaneled by the government. And interestingly, this auditor is, you know, may be also asked to give trust calls. Now, the possibility of, you know, independent auditors giving private parties trust calls is obviously to be seen how it, you know, effectively plays out. But this is one of the things that the proposed law includes. The proposed law also talks about a data protection impact assessment. So the DPIA is supposed to be done whenever there's new technology being used, large-scale profiling, use of sensitive personal data such as genetic data or biometrics, or any other kind of high-risk processing. All of these require a data protection impact assessment before being done, and such a report will need to be submitted to the authority. And the authority, you know, will if it believes that, you know, it should not be done, it will come back. But I think if this report will include stuff like, you know, the risk of harm to individuals, the measures that the entity is taking to mitigate such harms. So I think in essence, you know, given the fact that it's not clear as to who would be a significant data fiduciary, I think more criteria other than just what the law currently lays down would need to be set out for further clarity on this.
Thanks, Karthik. Yesterday when we were discussing, you know, about the same subject, a couple of interesting questions came up, especially from the banking sector, whether the significant data fiduciary could apply to the banking sector. Now, as I mentioned earlier, the law is not at all, you know, talking about any specific sector. It's a very plain law in terms of, completely sector agnostic from a drafting perspective. But there would be these situations, for example, in the banking sector, it is a very heavily regulated sector in terms of even the security measures they need to adopt, the kind of consent that they need to take, the kind of exchange of, account opening information, etc. So if at all there is already a regulator which is, you know, overlooking the compliances of a particular sector, the question will arise that whether if at all they could again classify themselves, those entities in those sectors as a significant data fiduciary and have these onerous obligations, then, you know, whether then that means that industry is, you know, answerable to two separate regulations for similar issues. So I hope, you know, there is some kind of consensus built in among different industries and the data protection authority that which are the areas which could be probably excluded, from the ambit of SDS and when they already have an existing regulator. So I will move on, Aaron, to you. Why don't we discuss about, the sort of rights of the data principles that, you know, very briefly, especially why don't you, discuss about right to be forgotten? How is it somewhat different than the GDPR? Very briefly on the data portability, because that's a new concept and we are going to see some, onerous obligations there. And of course, briefly a concept of a privacy by design. So if you can cover these three aspects, that would be good.
Sure, Gauri, thank you. So I'll just spend a minute actually on privacy by design before going to the right to be forgotten. Privacy by design, you know, as you all know, and in the context of the GDPR, GDPR also is essentially managerial, organizational, business, technical policies and measures that organizations need to implement. The overall objective is to anticipate, identify, and avoid harm to the data subjects. Now, broad principles have been given in the draft bill with respect to implementing privacy by design. However, one key takeaway is that this is something for businesses introducing new products during the R&D phase, innovating at these various stages to, at that stage, implement these kind of principles at the time, at the inception stage, essentially, with respect to a particular product at the time of development. So this is something that startups, new businesses, as well as existing businesses with new products should all keep in mind, that these policies and measures would need to be implemented at a very nascent stage, at the time of development, essentially. Now, moving on to the right to be forgotten. Now, essentially, this concept has also been taken from the GDPR. The right to be forgotten is essentially a right conferred on the data principle. However, it's not an absolute right. Why? Because it cannot be exercised absolutely. It is left to the discretion of the data protection authority after making a request. Now, essentially, what does the right entail? The right is essentially against continuing disclosure of certain information of the data subject. However, it is not a right to delete per se. The request can be initiated by a data subject in either of three circumstances. One is where the information that was collected has served its purpose and is no longer necessary. Two, where consent earlier given by the data subject has now been revoked. And the third, where the collection or processing is in itself violative of the law. In either of these three circumstances, a request can be made by the data subject to the Data Protection Authority. The Data Protection Authority will consider the request and will decide for or against, and accordingly, an order may be passed with respect to this right. Now, while I said it wasn't a right to deletion or erasure per se, it is an indirect right to deletion in essence, because once consent is essentially revoked or once the purpose limitation has been fulfilled, the data fiduciary has an obligation to delete the data anyway. So hence, you could call it an indirect right to delete or erase the data. One practical issue that we see in exercising this right to be forgotten is that there is no timeline in which the authority needs to respond to such requests. And also, given that this request has been given openly to data subjects, we may find a lot of requests being submitted and a multiplicity of proceedings occurring before the authority. And those may be some teething and operational hurdles that we may see in actually enforcing this right.
Thanks, Aaron. Karthik, since we are talking about rights of the users, I think children's data becomes one of the key aspects here, because as we know, actually it is the younger generation who is actually more digital savvy than the elder, and they are directly online. Of course, maybe under parental guidance, but they have access right from the age of probably 12, 13. So how does this law look at, the children's data, who the child has defined, if you can throw some light on that?
Sure, Gavri. So just in terms of children's data, I think first and before we begin this discussion, I think it would be interesting for us to note that a child for the purposes of this data protection law has been defined as someone who's below the age of 18 years. So effectively what this does is this rules out everyone under the age of 18 to be using, to use or to consent without parental, who requires parental consent. So essentially what this does is this is anyway in line with the Indian Contract Act, which says that a minor cannot contract. But given, the experience in other jurisdictions where for accessing digital services, the age for consent has been lowered. This was something which, the committee could have considered and should have possibly considered, given the fact that a lot of edtech products are coming up which are focused at young adults, especially between the ages of 15 to 18, as well as there's a lot of social gaming activity happening. So I think that's one important aspect. The other important aspect is the fact that they've created a new kind of data fiduciary who's essentially a guardian data fiduciary. A guardian data fiduciary is anyone who operates websites or online services directed at children, or someone who processes large amounts of children's data. Interestingly, a data fiduciary who's an entity who's notified as a data fiduciary cannot profile, track, monitor behavior, or offer targeting and advertising directed at children. So essentially what this does is that, you know, the ability to offer suggestions in terms of better user experience, that gets ruled out given the lack of ability to track or monitor behavior. Similarly, for businesses that were dependent on advertising revenue, targeted advertising is now ruled out. So effectively what we're looking at is possibly, you know, new business models coming up due to this, or you know, businesses evolving due to the fact that they can't do targeted advertising.
Right. You know, in this overall scheme of things, you know, there have been debates before as to who should be the child in terms of age, and the committee also deliberated on that. But it seems that, you know, they all came back and agreed that it should be 18 years. Now, Huzaifa, why don't we discuss about some interesting issues on data localization, which I had alluded before? How do you see the cross-border data transfers, you know, working out? And how do you believe that is going to affect, you know, all these new provisions are going to affect the, you know, the trade and the commerce?
No, absolutely, Gauri, you've nailed it. And also earlier in, you know, while we were introducing this topic, one of the pain points or one of the fears of the industry were both these two. One are cross-border transfers and second, the requirements of data localization. So there has been a recent regulatory changes in India, where industries are moving towards data localization. One, of course, in the fintech space, banks and payment gateways need to keep financial data in India, only in India. There are proposed healthcare laws like Disha, which was mentioned, which also focus on data localization. So we already have a channel where industries are trying to focus on verticals within itself in relation to data localization. But there is something addition which has happened as per this bill. The bill casts a blanket obligation on the data fiduciary to have a copy in India of personal data which is collected from the data principal on a server or data center. So friends, there are three requirements. The first requirement is that any data fiduciary who's collecting personal data is obliged to have a copy in India. That's one. And second, it needs to be on a data center or a server located in India, which essentially means that the backup copy or the sole copy needs to be in a digital format. Now, of course, there are a few questions which remain unanswered is, you know, what about the mom and pop shops or, you know, the other shops which don't have things digitized? So they may be processing personal data. The Act applies to them, but they may be doing it in a manual form or in a hard copy form. But for such organizations, of course, they now would need to digitize. The second interesting part in all of this is that, as my colleagues mentioned, that the Act has extraterritorial jurisdiction, which means that foreign companies who are targeting Indian customers and are providing services and goods to such Indian customers and pursuant to that are collecting personal data from the data principal are also subject to compliances under this Act. Now, there are numerous examples whereby the foreign presence does not have any presence in India, physical or, you know, virtual presence in India, but is still providing goods and services to, you know, customers. In such cases, with a requirement of a copy of data required to be stored in India, that opens up to two situations whereby the foreign companies would need to have a presence in India, and, you know, which would facilitate the copy of, you know, a copy in India to fulfill the data localization requirements, or they would need to contract with third parties to fulfill the requirements of such data localization. Now, of course, there are challenges which will, you know, unfold that, you know, what is the security processes in relation to such data localization when third parties are securing data on behalf of the data principal, also in terms of infrastructure costs. So all of these would, of course, need to be dealt with, but that's one side of it, and the second side, it may also lead to tax issues, creating permanent establishment issues. But currently, let's not jump the gun too much, because it's still early days, and once there is more jurisprudence on this, we will have a better path. So this is broadly in relation to data localization in for personal data. There is another category which has been identified by the government. It's called critical personal data, which is of course a notch above and a separate category, which is more sensitive than the personal data. For that category of data, the requirements on the data fiduciary is not about a copy. The data absolutely needs to be processed in India. So it's like a blanket embargo in which says that any critical personal data, if processed by the fiduciary, it only needs to happen in India. Just to conclude on that, the authorities have not come up with a definition, or they haven't identified what critical personal data is, but we just have to play the waiting game on that. So that's in relation to data localization under the new bill. Now, moving forward, something very interesting is the transfer of personal data, which is not domestic transfer, but is cross-border transfer. Now, under the old law, if the data principal has consented for transfer, then it was possible for an Indian data fiduciary to transfer it overseas, subject to, normal contractual provisions as per the earlier law. But the current bill has gone one step forward. What it says is that even though the data principal consents to the transfer overseas, a cross-border transfer, that would not be enough. That consent would not be enough. There are two other categories which need to be fulfilled, which says that the recipient, the transferee in the foreign country, that country should be notified as a country where the data could be transferred to, or the international organization to which the foreign transfer is happening should be notified or approved by the government. Now, of course, the government hasn't approved any territory right now or international organization, but they would do it sooner than later. The second category is that the transfer would be subject to standard contractual clauses or intra-group schemes. So the intent of the government is to roll out model clauses which would be present between the data fiduciary and the third-party cross-border transferring entity. And once those clauses are in place, and if the data principal consents to the transfer, that should be fine. But in both cases, we await standard contractual clauses and the intra-group schemes blessings from the authority, which should come soon. This, of course, I'll conclude by saying that business processing and the ITS industry, the compliances in relation to this, it's to be seen how things would be fulfilled. And probably, Gauri, over to you for closing comments on this point.
Sure. So couple of additional thoughts on this. Number one, interestingly, the drafting doesn't clarify that data localization is required only in relation to the data of the Indian data subject. As we have discussed before, our law not only gives protection to the personal data of the Indian citizens or residents, but also to the foreign residents whose data may be processed in India. So there is no clarity whether this localization requirement would even apply to such foreign individuals, because that is going to be a really onerous task, because there could be situations where the Indian data processors are simply providing outsourcing services to the foreign entities, and there is no other relationship per se, and they would be doing so by, say, having access which is a remote access. So I don't think the committee has looked into all these different models, business models that are being, that are developing in terms of, rendering services. So that is one area of concern I see. The second area of concern is, the point on data localization. The government does have the leeway to exclude certain, personal data from the compliance required of localization. However, such exclusion cannot be made in relation to the sensitive data. It cannot be made in relation to the sensitive data. Coming back to the point of password, that becomes an issue, because, for example, your streaming services, say a foreign entity providing streaming services directly in India, may only collect your password and no other information as such, insofar as sensitive data is concerned. And if that password is simply to access that service, then even for that simple aspect of password, do you need a data localization, right? So I mean, some of these, you know, issues will have to be clarified. Now, I know we are slightly running behind time, but a quick note on data breach. Aaron, why don't we quickly deal on data breach, and then I'll do a concluding remark for the webinar.
Sure, Gauri. So I'll make it very quick. 3-4 key points on personal data breaches. One is that it's applicable for personal data, which is wider than sensitive personal data. It's not restricted only to sensitive personal data. So when there is likelihood of harm being caused to the data subject, the data fiduciary should notify the authority of the breach, essentially, right? So the key test here is likelihood to cause harm. That is when the breach requirement is triggered. There is no time period in the draft law that's specified. The data protection authority has been given the power to prescribe time periods in which the data breaches should be reported. Importantly, as I said, there is a requirement to notify the authority. There is no direct requirement to notify the data subject. However, if the authority, once the breach has been reported to the authority, if the authority is of the view that the harm caused may be severe or already is severe, then the authority may ask the data fiduciary to report the breach directly to the data subject. So this requirement is only triggered if the authority requires it to be done. And accordingly, just supplementary point is that the authority also asked the data fiduciary to report, the authority would of course ask the data fiduciary to take necessary remedial action and necessary steps to mitigate the harm. So these are the essential points on the data breach.
Sure. Thanks, Aaron. Let me quickly deal with the consequences of non-compliance. Unfortunately, you know, the entire industry was actually hoping that, the criminal penalties do not get included in this law. But unfortunately, the criminal penalties in some cases have been included. In addition, of course, you do have penalties for non-compliance. These penalties will be towards the government, and you also have compensation to be paid to the data subject in case of, you know, in certain situations. So you have three levels of proceedings, you know, that when we look at in the context of this law. And the penalties, there was a fear that whether the global turnover will have to be taken into account at the time of calculation of penalties. So only in few cases, and you can, you know, refer to our update that has been sent to you. So only in certain situations that the global turnover will be taken into account, but not all. And compensation proceedings and penalty proceedings, whether there will be parallel, same proceedings, or, you know, it is not very clear. So, you know, there has to be much clarity that has to be brought to the table. We really hope that in the final form, the criminal penalties do go away. And there we do have one dissent in the committee report from one of the members saying that the criminal penalties should not be included under this law. Now coming to the next steps, where do we go from here? So this currently is only in a bill form. The METI, which is the ministry which is in charge of this bill, may do further deliberations, may amend the law, may, you know, put it to the parliamentary committee or to the law commission. You know, we'll just need to examine what is the method they adopt for further consultation. And thereafter, the law may get enacted. Now, there is likelihood that this, you know, the amended version gets placed before the parliament by the end of the year. If that doesn't happen, then maybe next year. When the bill is turned into the act, does it come into effect immediately? And the answer is no. As all of you have heard, that an authority will have to be established, as well as an appellate authority under the act to sort of deal with the appeals from the orders of the authority. So all this setup will have to be created, which we don't have at all in India. And then once the authority is set up, the authority will have to do further deliberations with the industry to come out with the codes of practices. Now, codes of practices essentially are the rules for implementation, of various aspects of the law. And unless and until these codes of practices are crystallized, it will be very difficult for the parties to actually go and implement the law. So if we see the overall timelines that have been provided, unfortunately, if you take the outer timeline available for the authority to come out with the codes of practices and the date of implementation of law, you merely have 6 months in between to do compliance. Whereas GDPR, we have seen, you know, they were given much more time. So we really hope that, you know, the industry gets better, you know, timelines in the final act. And we really hope that the act is implemented in a phase-wise manner so that, you know, the learnings, when I say phase-wise manner, either the provisions are not all provisions get kicked in at one go, or at least you identify certain data fiduciaries, probably because of the sensitivity of the data handled or the amount of data handled, you know, to have the law implemented to them first. And then, you know, look at the learnings, not only, you know, from the Indian law, but also from GDPR, because, you know, we do mimic to some extent the GDPR provisions. So see the overall, you know, the output of those compliances or the best practices developed, and then in a phase-wise manner adopt for the other, you know, other levels of data fiduciaries. Otherwise, you know, it's, even the 2011 rules, you know, which probably even after 7 years, when we look at some of the mid-size or small-size companies, even they are still struggling, you know, they have still not implemented those rules, which was a very, very, you know, simple kind of simplistic law to that extent. And then from there to move on to such a cumbersome law straight, I believe it's going to be very, very difficult to get those compliances in. So we really hope that the authorities and the government, you know, sort of take this point and have a phase-wise approach. So from a industry consultation perspective, we do believe that the industry needs to get together, identify the key pain areas, do further deliberations with the government. Maybe industry-wise codes of practices discussions should start, because different industries may have different requirements in the manner in which the consents could be implemented. And you know, the industry bodies could themselves come together, draft codes of practices and propose to the authority as and when established, so that the authority can endorse them. So I'll stop here, and thank you for being with us. And you know, we are happy to take any questions that you may have.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, we will now begin the question and answer session. Anyone wishing to ask a question may please press star and one on your touchtone telephone. If you wish to remove yourself from the question queue, you may press star and two. Participants are requested to use handsets while asking a question. Participants, if you wish to ask a question, you may please press star and one. The first question is from the line of Vivek Sherwani from Dream Plug Technologies. Please go ahead.
Yeah. So basically, the right to be forgotten, which is basically for three cases wherein the data subject can make a request to the authority for the right to be forgotten. I just need some clarification on what effort will the data subject or the data principal will have to make to request the authority for the right to be forgotten.
Aaron?
Sure, Gauri, thank you. Now, it's clarified that we have mentioned that a request needs to be made, right? There are certain parameters which need to be mentioned and which the adjudicating officer will take into consideration when passing the order, right? Now, these are five specific conditions. One is that what is the sensitivity of the data in question? Two, what is the scale of the disclosure and the degree of accessibility which is sought to be restricted? In essence, to what extent of restriction is the data subject actually asking for? The third is, what role does the individual play in public life? Now, this is a little ambiguous. There's no further explanation on this, but essentially it's what kind of standing does the data subject have in society or in public life? The next question is, the next parameters of follow-up to this, because it talks about what is the relevance of the data to the public. So I think the role of the subject in society as well as the relevance of his or her personal data to the society will be taken into consideration. And the last is that what is the nature of the disclosure and the activities of the fiduciary facilitating the access to the data? What exactly is such, in essence, it's what exactly is the fiduciary undertaking which is likely to cause harm or which is causing harm to the data subject, and how the continuing disclosure is continuing to harm the data subject. So these are the broad 5 points which, one, the data subject has to address, and two, which the adjudication officer will consider when passing the order.
Got it.
Thank you. The next question is on the line of Aditi Shroff, an individual investor. Please go ahead.
Hi. So we see today, even when it comes to cases under the Information Technology Act, we have the adjudicating officer in place, but again, the Cyber Appellate Tribunal has not been functioning since 2011. So how does the current government propose to fill in those gaps to make sure that the implementation of this also takes place effectively?
I think that's a very good question, and that's exactly, you know, we were debating internally, because if you see what has happened, unfortunately, you know, in so far as implementation of IT Act itself, there has been some amount of laxity in terms of appointments, right? And yes. Then the government is also looking at, you know, combining various appellate authorities, etc. So, you know, we had this flurry of, you know, combination of different appellate tribunals, which were sometimes even unrelated tribunals got, you know, combined. So in that context, you know, even we are wondering that, you know, do they have the wherewithal or a setup, you know, because this is going to be a very technology focused from an implementation perspective law. And, you know, this is a huge machinery they have to actually create. And if they have not been able to do so, even, you know, with the existing Information Technology Act,
right,
how do they, you know, sort of propose to do so? And that's a very valid question. We just have to wait and watch.
Right, because at present, there are a lot of writ petitions that are filed from the, you know, pending orders from the AO directly to the High Court, which is again stifling the High Courts. And at present, we're not seeing any movement on any appointment happening in the CYAT. So, yeah, we'll have to just wait and watch.
Completely agree.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you. The next question is on the line of Biscuit Agmo from Anand Kemani. Please go ahead.
Hi, I actually had a clarification as well as a question. The clarification I wanted to ask Huzaifa, he was talking about certain relaxations for processing by, say, the government or in emergency situations or between an employer-employee. And then he spoke about sensitive personal data in such scenarios. I think the line broke a little bit, but am I correct in assuming that when it comes to sensitive personal data, these relaxations are removed?
That was Aaron, in fact, answering. So, Aaron, why don't you take it?
Yes, hi. This is Aaron. Hi.
So,
Sorry, I'll just clarify that, that is correct. The broad principle is that explicit consent is required for sensitive personal data. The carve-out, the exception for legitimate processing are functions of the state, such as acts of parliament, so and so, to comply with law or orders of the court, as well as where the data is required in the case of prompt actions, such as in the case of medical emergencies or medical treatment. So
but that's for sensitive personal data as well, and not just personal data, is it?
No, that is for both. That is for both. That is common for personal data and sensitive personal data. The only difference is, as we had earlier mentioned, Gauri had also spoken, is that the employee-employer relationship,
yeah,
that is only for personal data. That has not been carved out for sensitive personal data.
Sensitive personal data, okay. And over here, speaking of employees, we're talking about like the definition of employees as per our labor laws.
That definition has been, the definition will have to be understood by the general understanding of employer-employee relationship. And, you know, you have also seen situations, you know, in so far as Contract Labor Act, then how will it apply, right? I mean, those are the questions that do arise. Secondly, there are situations when, you know, the nomenclature is consultant, however, you know, the nature of relationship,
the
courts recognize, you know, to be actually that of employer-employee.
Yeah.
So, you know, those are the situations we'll need to examine, you know, on a case-to-case basis, but these are really valid questions that are coming up.
Okay, and also just one more clarification. So when we speak of critical personal data, there's really no clarification in terms of relaxations there, right?
That is correct.
Okay. That's correct. And critical personal data needs to be identified by the authority of what would constitute as critical. So that has not yet happened.
Which has not been done yet. Okay, so I had another quick question. Have we discussed a scenario where fiduciary actually collects data from corporate entity and not a natural person, but the information relates to a data principal who's a natural person?
Sorry, could you repeat your question, please? I think the line just got...
No, I'm saying that does the bill, discuss a situation where the data fiduciary collects information, that information is collected from a corporate entity, but the information actually relates to natural data principles?
Yes, it actually does have such a situation. We actually did not delve into much detail, but actually it's covered under the bill, under, you know, Section 8 of the notice section, which actually provides certain criteria if the data is not directly collected, but is indirectly received, what needs to be undertaken. There are certain compliances which need to be undertaken.
Okay.
Thank you. The next question is on the line of Naman Agarwal from Axis. Please go ahead.
Hi guys, thank you for the detailed explanation of the bill and good to hear from you after so long. I just wanted to ask about notice and consent. It seems that notice has been placed at the time of collection, whereas consent is at the time of processing. So what implications does that have? For example, does it mean that at the time of onboarding a customer, a company can only give notice and take consent later, making the onboarding process less cumbersome?
No, thanks, Naman. But I think the general, it would need to be looked at more from an objective purpose, that consent would apply at the time. So when a data principal is giving its data to the data fiduciary, the step which would have to be undertaken is for the data to flow from the fiduciary, from the principal to the fiduciary. Of course, consent would need to be taken. So I don't think there would be scenarios in which, you know, consent would be typically taken after the data is shared. So it would probably happen more or less at that point in time itself.
Yeah, and if you see the definition of processing, it includes collection, right? So the way they have given clause 8, this section 8, they simply say no later than at the time of collection. So basically they believe that, you know, collection may be the first step of processing, and that's the reason they may have, you know, clarified in that manner.
Got it. Thank you.
Thank you. The next question is on the line of Ramnadula Iyengar from Credit Suisse. Please go ahead.
Hello. So my question is with regard to outsourcing situations. I know that there is not much of clarity given, but I see in the document that you all shared in the table that it can be possibly exempted in the case of an outsourcing contract. So if I have an outsourcing contract and it's agreed between the data fiduciary who's outside of India and me being the data processor in India, can I, be exempted from the regulation as such?
Sure. So it will also depend on the whose data are you processing, right?
The data being processed is of foreign persons.
Sure. So currently the law applies, you know, across. However, if you see Section 104, the government has the ability to provide such exemptions in the context of, these situations that you mentioned. I'll tell you why, you know, it was, if you just step back, India has been struggling to get the safe harbor with some of the jurisdictions, right, in terms of, you know, being an, you know, to comply with the adequacy test. So for the purpose of compliance of the adequacy test, say, for example, with EU, you have to show that you are giving equal protection to the data, you know, the protection to their data subjects in India, right? So therefore, you needed to include that as a part of your law to say that as a principle, we do, recognize that. However, because in these situations where two separate sets of laws will apply, correct? Because as a processor, you need to comply with the contractual obligations that will be imposed on you by your fiduciary, say, from EU, correct?
Right.
So you have to, contractually comply with, say, a GDPR provision. In addition, you are burdened with the Indian law provision. So that is the situation, I believe, they have recognized, and therefore, they have said that they may, give exclusion, and the power has been given to the central government to provide such exclusion.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. The next question is on the line of Swasti Gupta from Kutch International. Please go ahead.
Hello.
Yes, Swasti.
Yeah, good afternoon.
So we wanted to ask that you talked about how the law is going to be applied, sector agnostic is going to be applied in a horizontal manner. So will this put India in the same situation as the commodity scam case, which happened a while back, where there was jurisdiction overlapping and confusion, which led to no sector regulator taking lead in accountability?
See, at least in this context, the data, the nodal agency will be the data protection authority that will be established under this law, and therefore they will apply the law, in a sector agnostic manner, right?
Right.
However, what they are saying is there will be other laws that will have to be brought in compliance with this law. So I don't believe that is the situation you are looking at. You are looking at, in fact, the other way around, that two, three regulators simultaneously trying to, impose obligations on you, leading to over-regulation.
Right. Over-regulation or no regulation at all in terms of a confusion or a void being created where nobody is taking responsibility, thinking the other regulators don't do. This is the other regulator.
I think that's a good question. So for example, they say that, we suppose to, answer your this particular question, suppose they give an exemption, the same example that I was giving before, saying that let the banking regulator take care of, some of these compliances. We are giving, exemption to the banking industry,
right?
As a overall exemption. And the banking regulator doesn't do anything about it, for a while, then yes, that void may get created. If at all, something, that kind of a situation arises.
Yeah, okay, yeah, that was my question. Hello?
Yes.
Yeah, I wanted to ask one more question that you talked about the industry consultative process going on in a certain way. But there has been no cost-benefit analysis in terms of weighing the potential benefits versus the likely harm this bill can do. So do you think the industry should come together in conducting such an analysis? And how?
You're absolutely
how
right. If you see, there were some of these, items that, in some pockets that analysis was provided, for example, in the context of, not having proper data transfer, provisions or localization issues. So there is some amount of data, but you're right, there isn't any concrete, analysis, because, all these concepts were still floating concepts. Now you at least have a crystallized, draft that is in front of you. So it may be a good idea to identify some of the four or five key pain points and do that kind of an analysis and, present to the government, because honestly, if you ask me, it's not as if, the entire country is going to get into compliance, day one, right? So, in that context, which are the key things which could be implemented before, some could be postponed, that is the kind of, discussion that is required.
Right, because in terms of local storage and processing of data, there are a lot of new industries and startups which might get affected in this scenario. And there is no empirical evidence-based data in terms of implementation of this bill and the benefits and the harm it could cause.
Right. You're right.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Ma'am, that was the last question.
Thank you. And, this is not the end. This is the beginning of a new data protection regime in India. As a user, I'm happy that the government has, sort of, you know, sort of started looking at this very, very seriously. But, you know, from an overall industry perspective, some dilution is definitely required from this bill. There are certain practical difficulties that will have to be taken into account, and a phased-wise implementation should be the way ahead. If you have, you know, the participants have any other questions, feel free to drop us an email. We'll be happy to chat because this is going to be an ongoing process of discussion. And since we represent quite a few industry organizations to make these recommendations, we would be more than happy to, you know, receive suggestions which will sort of enhance our thought process as well. So feel free, please feel free to write to us. Thank you, and over, you know, back to you. You know, from a Chorus Call team to conclude. Thanks to all the participants for being with us today. Have a good day.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of Nishit Desai Associates, that concludes this conference. Thank you for joining us, and you may now disconnect your lines. Thank you.
Thank you.